It's 11 minutes before the hour. You're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW Sitka. Today is Tuesday, March 5th. I'm Erin Fulton with Raven News. A new nonprofit group hoping to protect the small-town character of Sitka went public last week. Besides limiting cruise ship passengers, Sitka Soul, or Save Our Unique Lifestyle, has a stated mission of protecting Sitka's rural subsistence designation, which comes up for periodic review by the Federal Subsistence Board. Ketchikan is undergoing this review right now. Under federal subsistence law, Ketchikan's population of around 14,000 people disqualifies it as rural, but the Ketchikan Indian community has been pushing the Federal Subsistence Board to reconsider that designation. The tribe says the moves would give them more cultural agency over their traditional subsistence-based way of life, but just as in Sitka, would also open up federal subsistence hunts and fisheries to non-native Ketchikan residents. KRBD's Jack Darrell has more.
Tony Gallegos is the Cultural and Natural Resource Director for the Ketchikan Indian community. He says this isn't really about whether Ketchikan is an urban or rural community. It's about his people's way of life.
The main benefit and our goal is really not for the urban rural, but for our tribal members to be considered federally recognized subsistence users.
That designation, federally recognized subsistence user, allows individuals to hunt, fish, and gather under subsistence rules, not just sport fishing and hunting rules, or even personal use fishing or hunting rules, but subsistence, which is prioritized over other user groups in terms of game management. It's a long and bureaucratic battle that Gallegos and KIC have been fighting for years. This is the third time the tribe has attempted to get the status changed. KIC's proposal was heard by the city and borough of Ketchikan in 2021, who both passed resolutions in support. Then, they had to get approval from the Southeast Alaska Regional Subsistence Advisory Council, or CRAC. In 2022, that council voted to move it forward to the Federal Subsistence Board, and around this time last year, the feds voted to conduct a formal two-year study into the idea. They're in the middle of that study right now. And so far, two public hearings were held in October on the subject, one in Ketchikan and the other in Klawak on Prince of Wales Island. The study is conducted by the Office of Subsistence Management, which falls under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife umbrella. Gallegos says the public testimony from the final hearing, which happened on February 6th, will be compiled for CRAC. CRAC will then present their formal recommendation for the first time in October. CRAC's October recommendation is important because Gallegos says that historically, the Federal Subsistence Board typically defers to the regional authorities' recommendations.
And they have to have some strong reasons to go against the Regional Advisory Council.
In other words, if CRAC recommends changing Ketchikan's status in October, then, based on precedent, it would be a shocking upset if the final federal vote didn't go the same way.
We are really hoping that we hear in October that the staff of the Office of Subsistence Management can recommend us wholeheartedly to be considered rural.
It still hinges on one key question. Is Ketchikan a rural community? Gallegos says there are those who would say it isn't, and some members of the opposition are worried about what would happen if the entire population of Ketchikan suddenly became federally recognized subsistence users.
The main opposition is related to the concern that there might be not enough resources.
This sentiment was expressed back in 2022 at the meeting when CRAC voted to advance the proposal. Councilmember Louis Wagner Jr. of Metlakatla was one of the council members opposed to the change.
This is really serious. It's going to put a huge impact on the villages, and especially Prince of Wales.
Prince of Wales Island is a ferry ride away from Ketchikan and a popular destination for hunting black-tailed deer. There are concerns that a larger pool of subsistence users could put pressure on the already limited population of deer on the island. Gallegos says he doesn't see it that way.
There are several ways to address that. It's not our intent to do that. We just want access to the resources here within the Ketchikan area.
The federal public hearing was held via teleconference on February 6th. According to the Office of Subsistence Management, who hosted the hearing, 10 people testified, and all of them spoke in favor of changing the designation to rural. Forrest Haven grew up in Metlakatla and now teaches anthropology and Alaska Native Studies at the University of Alaska Southeast. She was at the meeting and says that those who testified were in support of the status change.
Every person that called in talked about wanting to make sure that they can still, you know, harvest seaweed or, you know, provide food for their elders, or, you know, they were very real concerns about wanting to be able to continue their traditional food practices in a meaningful way.
Ketchikan is one of the landless five, a term that refers to the five Native communities in Alaska that weren't given any of their lands back under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in the 70s. A few miles down the road from Ketchikan, though, things went differently. Native community members from Saxman became shareholders of their own Native corporation under ANCSA, Cape Fox Corporation, and received a land settlement. Saxman was also considered urban until they were able to get the status changed about a decade ago. From an anthropological perspective, Haven echoes what Indigenous Ketchikan residents have been arguing for years. Being recognized as subsistence users is about spiritual practices and cultural food sovereignty.
So I think if by normal standards, you know, in the U.S., Ketchikan would absolutely be considered a rural area, right? It's cut off from a road system. You only have a couple of grocery stores. But by Alaska standards, it's considered an urban area. So it's really inhibited this really fundamental component of like cultural revitalization and tribal sovereignty.
The Federal Subsistence Board will be reviewing a summary of all comments received at this and the previous two public hearings when it makes a final decision on the proposal in January of 2025. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
It's been nearly three decades since the U.S. Forest Service released their first management plan for the Tongass National Forest, and a lot has changed since 1997. During a presentation at the Juneau Economic Development Council's Innovation Summit last week, Southeast Alaska's Deputy Forester, Chad Van Ormer, said it's time for an update.
The forest plan is really kind of a compass, is how I like to look at it. And it kind of gives a direction on our desired future outcomes.
Van Ormer started his career on Prince of Wales Island just a few years after the original forest plan came out. Back then, there were only about 500,000 cruise ship passengers visiting the Tongass region. Now the tourism boom has arrived in full force with 1.7 million visitors last year, and the number of tour guiding businesses in the forest has more than doubled. And time has revealed new threats that will shape the Tongass and the communities that rely on it. Van Ormer said climate resilience planning will be priorities in the new plan.
Climate change wasn't even a thought in the forest plan. It wasn't even really contemplated. And here we are today where it's really frontline headline news. And we have a forest plan currently that doesn't really prepare ourselves for it.
To make a plan that works for the present day, the agency wants to strengthen relationships with community organizers and tribal governments. Van Ormer said the introduction of the Southeast Sustainability Strategy in 2021 set a precedent for that by sending millions in funding to tribal and indigenous organizations for sustainable development projects, things like forest restoration, trail work, and indigenous cultural education projects. A lot of that work has already begun.
We have multiple crews that are working, doing stewardship on the landscape. But they aren't Forest Service crews. They're local tribal crews. They're other youth crews. There are other scientists and coming to the table and really wanting to roll up their sleeve and expand the capacity and scope and breadth of the work here on the National Forest.
Van Ormer said the new plan will set the foundation for more projects like that. The Forest Service will spend the next year hosting workshops around Southeast Alaska to gather input on the next version of the plan. It will likely take 2 to 3 more years to finalize it. After nearly a year of renovations, Juneau's Augustus Brown Pool is finally reopening. KTOO's Clarice Larson attended Friday's reopening and reports that while it doesn't look a lot different, the half-century-old pool is now more energy efficient and accessible for swimmers.
Are you ready? Maybe. Okay. 1, 2, 3.
More than 50 people gathered outside the downtown pool's front entrance on Friday to witness the ribbon-cutting ceremony and grand reveal of the pool's multi-million dollar renovations. Juneau Parks and Recreation Director George Schaff said without the Juneau community's long-standing support for the more than 50-year-old pool, the renovations wouldn't have been able to happen.
I want to say thank you to the community of Juneau. You showed at the ballot box how important this pool is to you, and we are so excited to have Juneau be back to being a two-pool town again.
Schaff said contractors have spent the last 11 months on upgrades that many swimmers might not notice, like new boilers, electric plumbing, and ventilation. But there are some noticeable changes too, like a resurfaced leisure pool and remodeled locker rooms. The painted tiles that once lined the locker room showers were also replaced with new ones during the renovations, and high-resolution photos of the original 1999 designs now line the lobby. After the ribbon-cutting ceremony concluded, residents were invited inside where Tlingit elders led a blessing of the water.
J-Y-A-K-A.
Juneau Douglas High School Yadat Kathle Jr. Elia Yerkes was one of the many who took the chance to walk around and explore the renovations. She said she grew up swimming in the pool and is excited to get back in the water after so long without it.
I always grew up in this pool. My grandfather really likes to swim, and he'd always bring me down here and my cousins, and we just play around, and it's nice having it back open again because I've missed it.
Another person excited to get back in the water is former Assembly member Carol Treem, who was a driving force behind an Assembly appropriation in 2021 that helped fund the $8 million renovation.
I woke up and I said, pool day, pool day, pool day. It's just really great to see this open again and to be on the deck. I haven't been here for so long. I can't wait to dive in the pool. I did bring my swimsuit. Do you think they will let me?
Users will be able to test the new waters during the pool's soft opening Monday, followed by an official grand reopening and community free swim on Saturday. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
I'm Erin Fulton, and this has been Raven News.